And welcome to the Aries call, the 28th. This call is recorded. I mostly write that so I remember to record it. Please be mindful of the Hyperledger Code of Conduct. Be excellent to each other and the antitrust policy. Don't do illegal stuff. It impedes our community. So we have some good topics today. That in the inline keys in particular has been a hot topic this last week during the issues, the RFC issues. So that's a good one. Announcements. The December 3rd through the 5th in Provo, Utah is going to be an Aries Workshop Connectathon. Details to follow on that. The other thing that I've done here, I may get in trouble for this because I didn't really ask permission, but we are currently working on the already late but necessary Aries quarterly report to the Hyperledger Foundation. Here's a link that will let you comment and suggest contributions to that. If you have a project or you've been working on something significant and you would like to see how it's represented in that report, then please go ahead and you can add any comments there. We hope to have this wrapped up by the end of today or at the very latest early tomorrow and submitted to the Hyperledger organization as a review of those projects. So this is the first one we've done because new projects get a buy on the first one, but it's now been 2 quarters since the Aries project has started. I did copy that from an indie one as a template. And so if you find something related to indie then that doesn't match, then just please replace it with something that does or remove it. And I'll go ahead and get working on that. But I had to take a pause to make sure that we could, you know, have a meeting today and make that happen. So that's there. Any other announcements that aren't on the list? Okay. I have a related meetings review this morning. This was the week for the every other week morning Aries call that better serves our European friends and to let them come. I had a good threading model discussion on it. Ken, can you summarize that briefly for us? Or is that possible to summarize?
I'll give it a shot. Let me pull up the image so that we can have something to talk about.
I'm kind of looking for a brief 1 or 2 minute, and then we have the recording is already posted for that call. So let me stop sharing if you want to share.
I do indeed want to share.
I bring this up because it's an important conversation. We don't necessarily need to rehash the entire conversation, but this is something that the community should be aware of. The hardest thing to transition from indie to Aries has been the split up of the SDK, and this is, we've made a lot of progress recently, and I'll shut it for a second so Ken can talk.
Okay, I'm just going to give a quick overview. This is the vision of the current split up for pluggable resolvers, pluggable wallets, pluggable credential implementations so that we can implement at the aggregate function level, the W3C specification for verifiable credentials, and support the various different types of signature schemes that they have, including ZKPs, JOTs, linked data signatures. We have 2 implementations of wallets so far, SQLite and a Postgres wallet. Implementations of resolvers will expand to include those other ledgers, so Fabric, Sawtooth, whoever wants to contribute there. We looked at models for the different types of processing that we have with large weights on things and small processing. And we had a contrasting large processing with small weights, and we talked about accommodating both those in an async and a synchronous model. Follow the discussion as it goes on. We posted this document in with these SDK migration stuff. So if you want more details, you can refer to the document there and follow the conversation on the morning calls with Aries. End of summary. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Ken. And that's good there. If you are not, haven't been going to those morning calls or listening to them, then that would be worthy of your attention if you desire to be involved in that conversation. This will shape the future of the pluggability of the sort of core Aries SDKs that make it easy to build stuff on top of. We have projects further along than the SDK because of the weird circumstance where we decided to use the indie SDK in the meantime to be able to continuing furthering agent work and everything else. And we look forward to replacing that with the Aries SDK that serves wider models much, much better. So, um, So please, if you're interested in, and we're not at that meeting this morning, you can go and find that. Those meetings you can find, by the way, in the wiki, in the Aries Working Group call here. They will show up under U.S. Morning is the one that we've got here. So here's the one from today that has the linked information from it, as well as the recording of the meeting there, so that you can catch up on what happened. So that's good. Other related calls. We have Ursa, Indy contributors. Any other calls that we want to report on? I'm going to let people volunteer themselves.
Quick update. The Indy maintainers call is now called the Indy contributors call, and we are taking next Monday off due to holidays and rebooting Web of Trust. And the wiki has all the wiki.
If no one has said anything yet, make sure you vote in the Hyperledger elections. If you have any commit to the code base over the course of the last year or a significant contribution to a working group, you should have received a ballot. Make sure you participate in that election.
Yes. Should that have come via email?
Yes, you should have received an email quite some time ago about joining the Hyperledger contributors mailing list if you have a contribution. And then if you respond to that emailing list, you will have received the updates. They started the ballot on Monday, but then they had to turn it off and restart it. There were several people who had to either add or remove themselves from the list because either they were nominated by someone else and they didn't want to be on the ballot, or they'd had technical difficulties getting on the ballot. So today the list went out. So please vote for those folks who you think will best support and represent the Aries community.
Awesome. Other calls? Okay. For the upcoming worker updates, I stole this list from the morning call since those have been given, so we can review those if those folks aren't there. I'd love to run down the list real quick. Aries Cloud Edge Python.
3.1 released, 0.3.1 released, working right now on revocation support. We've got revocation working, so working out some test cases and so on. So revocation is coming soon. That's based on an OnCreds 1.0 with Tails files and the like. That's it.
Awesome. Also, there is a PR that I've submitted to that has queuing. It is probably not ready to merge via some things that we need to discuss and just figure out the right way to do things. But if you're interested in queuing in there, then the PR exists in that repo. Aries framework, go.
Hey there. Same as last week, we are working on the first milestone. You can check out the information in the wiki. We've posted some information about planning and stand-up meetings in the wiki as well. The link is in the agenda. I was going to note that we also done some of the second milestone work in parallel. So there's an initial verifiable credential parser committed into the repository, and we'll be building up from there.
Awesome. And those daily stand-up meetings have a link into the wiki with notes for those interested in being involved. Aries SDK Ruby with Jack. I didn't see if Jack's on. He reported this morning that he had looked a lot into synchronous, like blocking threads and a lot of things there, and researched the best options there, and so had some initial work within the library to make that work. And then we announced this last time, but the ariesframework.net has been contributed by StreetCred, which is fantastic. Anything else on .net? Okay, SDK Python.
So we had a PR come in to the Indy SDK actually for an experimental type Python wrapper for the Indy SDK. We're looking to instead adopt that into the Aries SDK Python. We're discussing how we can adopt some of the ideas from that. It's pretty cool. Uses decorators and simplifies the wrapper. So we're excited about that.
Awesome. Java?
Hi, this is Mushmi here.
Yes, please.
Yeah, there has been some interest in Java SDK. I've started looking at the Indie Java wrapper files. We haven't formalized yet anything, but starting point would be to go over the Indie Java SDK and we'll take it from there.
Awesome. Forward progress is good and having a starting place is helpful. SDK JavaScript. Last I heard, there were some additional people that were interested in helping review things. So that's good. Just picking information that came out of the Aries RocketJet channel. Any updates for Indie SDK?
I'm working on a release this week. People who want more information can check out the notes in the last Indie Maintainers call, the future Indie Contributors call.
Yes, and for anyone who's confused while we're bringing this up, until we actually get the Aries split involved, we're still leaning on Indie SDK and reporting that here. So after the split happens and things get nice and clean, then that will remain a discussion of the Aries SDK. Ursa. Is mic on?
Doesn't look like it.
Ken, is that something you can summarize or I can take an attempt from this morning's call?
I think he was taking it from this morning's call. The big thing was the non-CRUD report. I think you can take that from this morning's call, but no big change on the ZKP or ZKLang stuff. That's all going forward. There's some question about where to deliver the Debian packages to, and I think that's being taken care of offline. And then some steady work going on the non-CRUDS 2.0s.
Yes. Okay. All right. Any other updates or announcements that we didn't get to that we ought to before we launch into what we're talking about? Okay. I'm first on the docket, and this shouldn't take long. I have a couple thoughts about the about routing protocols. So I've been working in getting the queuing stuff working, and there's a PR in for that. And the queue is useful for more than just message pickup, but rather message delivery as well, so that we can implement that. And the PR does not yet cover that because of some of the open questions that we have on how to implement some things inside of the code base. But but we're making progress towards that. So there's I've begun working on the other pieces here that we actually need to tie together and allow the open source mobile agent Ozma to connect and utilize the Aries Cloud Agent Python as a routing agent. And so the first one that I want to bring up, I wish I had a hype to point to, but I think in the transition, this hype was in the transition from a hype to an RFC, this hype was more or less retracted, pending future work. And so I can't find the source of it anymore at the moment. If you happen to know where that is, then I would love to know about it so that I can refer to that or use it to build up a new RFC. But part of this, specifically the route update and the route query information, I actually pulled from from an implementation that's already in the Aries Cloud Agent Python. And the idea here is that if you have a relationship with an agent, you would tell the agent about, you would have a conversation with them about them routing for you to make that happen. So things that already exist in that code base are the routing update request and response, and the request can contain key adds and deletes. And then the response is more or less an ACK of those things that occur. And then to get a key list, you can query and get a response back of the keys that the agent has and intends to route for you. They also implement the forward message, which does have an RFC that it relates to, but that RFC doesn't talk about sort of the management aspects of these things. And the piece I realized was missing was this route request and route information. And so what I'm doing is I want to describe what I'm talking about here in case there's related work that I'm unaware of, or someone would like to talk with me and get involved in this process. The route request and route information is more or less the question that like a mobile agent would ask to the routing agent and say, will you route for me? And then if the answer is yes, there's some information that the mobile agent actually needs to make it work. And And one of those is it needs to know the endpoint information, and it needs to know the routing keys necessary to pass along. So if the if a mobile agent calls to the routing agent and says, "Hey, will you route for me?" They send a route request, and then and if the answer is yes, the route information comes back and includes the endpoint that they should use and one or more routing keys that should be used in that process. And then the mobile agent knows that it can set up relationships with that, but when it issues new keys, then it has to issue a route update request to that routing agent so that it knows where to route the inbound messages when they arrive. I don't think this is particularly controversial, but this is a missing piece that we hadn't really talked about before. So it's going to be my attempt to hopefully find the previous hype so that I could draw from it and propose a new hype or a new RFC that that talks about how this function would actually occur. I have noted too that there are two roles relevant here. There's the router and the recipient is what I've named them preliminarily. The idea here is that when you do when a mobile agent connects to a cloud agent, and that can actually happen as long as the cloud agent supports both return route and the capability of queuing, you can set this stuff up and interact with that. They could do a feature discovery protocol and discover that this routing protocol is supported by that agent and has the role of a router. And then based on that information, it has the option to issue a route request to begin that process of making that happen. Any thoughts, comments, information about the routing protocol?
Hey, Sam.
Yep.
One thought I was thinking as you said this, the mobile agent, the edge agent, if there's multiple mediators, it would have to have this conversation with sort of how would that the multiple mediators piece work? Would it would talk to its closest mediator, and then that mediator would talk to the earlier one, one in front of it, something like that? I think that would have to happen that way.
It could, but there's actually a shortcut that's useful. Let's say I make a connection to the and there's an agent that says it can route for me, based on the supporting of this role. It might have already arranged an inbound path for itself, meaning it exactly. has an, some other agent and already has the routing keys. Which means, so I think what you're referring to is that if I do issue this route request that says, sure, I can route for you, and then I issue a route update request with a list of keys that I would like to be routed, then that agent would have to more or less forward that route update request to the upstream agent. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I was realizing that the closest mediator has to know what its upstream is, but as well, the edge agent, in order to put the list of keys into the routing keys array, has to know both of them.
So I just realized I was thinking along your lines, and then I realized that's why you provide a routing key. And what happens is that you wrap it in forward requests, right? Which means that the endpoint has to know which key to actually use. But then if it's previously registered that routing key with its mediator, then on receipt of the message, it doesn't have to know who the final recipient is. In fact, that's a feature of doing forwarding. It knows the key of the next hop. And so there's no like upstream transmission of routing keys.
No, sorry, I was thinking the other way around. The edge agent has to know both keys.
Yes.
Because it's got to put it into the DID doc. So it's got to know both. And then the one closest to it has to know the one of the agent in front of it. Just the one in front of it. But it can convey it as part of the route request between the edge and the closest cloud agent.
Yeah, so I thought I had the notes in here, but I don't. This has both the endpoint and routing key list. And that's a list of routing keys. which would include any keys that were necessary, you know, further along in the process.
Yeah. Pictures would be good on this.
Yeah, it sure would. Really what I need is a whole pipe. I just haven't yet had time to like
throw yeah, exactly.
together yep. and make it happen. So,
cool.
But yes, other thoughts, questions, comments about the routing protocol stuff that I'm talking about? Again, there will be an RFC at some point. I just haven't yet had the time to put it together. It's worth noting that this route request and route information might not be applicable in all circumstances. For example, if you are a service provider and you provide both an edge cloud routing agent and a mobile app, this would likely be pre-configured, but this information is still useful. Now, it's not required for you to support this particular protocol inside as long as it functions externally the same. But it's occurred to us that particularly in the support of a starting place for open source mobile agents, that having an option that can be supported is valuable. So this is not considered core in the same way that some of the other messages are. Forwarding is, and maybe it needs to live in a different protocol to make that more clear. But as far as the ability to you know service an inbound route request, that's not necessarily the same. And we'll see how that shakes out. I'm sure when we get to writing the RFC, that will become a little bit more clear.
Hey Sam.
Yeah.
Do you believe that this is fit more for internal domain configuration, and that routing would be done differently externally?
So my response to this is the same response that I should have given the last time you brought up domains. And the response is that domain is a concept, not a hard boundary.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how to answer that. I suspect that by the time this all settles and the world has changed and we all live in a happier place, that this will be used in more context than I imagine right now. So this isn't harmful to use outside of what we would consider a personal domain. And we'll just kind of have to see how that shakes out. And if there needs to be an alternative protocol for different applications, or this one needs to be extended in some way, then I anticipate we'll have those conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know is the answer.
Yeah. The reason I bring this up too is not security concerns this time. It's the complexity that you put on the receiver to identify a route. So it would be like on the internet today, me selecting the BGP route of how I get messages back to me. Whereas normally this is handled by, the middle backbone intermediary hops. And so that's what I was trying to take into consideration is like right now, a lot of the routing is handled by the two endpoints between messages. And it doesn't feel very dynamic in nature, and it requires them to know everything about it. And I think that could be a lot more complex than we expect.
So I think there's the common case, and I think there's the advanced use cases. And in the common case, an agent's just going to have one endpoint that they use, and they're just going to use that, and it's fine. In the common case, an agent can decide to hand out different endpoints to different people depending on whatever attributes of routing they're going after. And the short answer is that I believe that the common case here is simple enough that it's really not that hard. And so specifically, this is only really that involved if you have an agent that doesn't have an inbound endpoint that it can use. So mobile apps or other static agents fall into that category. If you're running an enterprise agent, let's say that represents a company or an organization, this isn't a concern you generally have. You can still use these, the routing protocols like this in order to set up inbound routes for herd privacy. But I think I'm confident that it's simple enough for the security advantages it gives us that it works well. One of the problems with IP addresses we have on the internet is that unless you set up some sort of masking, either via proxy or some other thing, you actually lose a bunch of privacy in the process. And so I'm comfortable with the trade-off we have with a little bit of increased complexity for the privacy trade-off that we're getting.
The other thing is, The only thing you have to include are mediators. You can have as many relays as you want if you want to have dynamic routing through your, through whatever scope you want. Those are all done without need to publish out that you're doing that. But these are just mediators. I don't see how they would apply outside the domain, because you're basically saying, oh, by the way, I need a key that you're going to use to route to me. By almost by definition, that's inside the domain. So I still think it's kind of fuzzy, but I doubt it's necessary outside the domain, as we've defined what that is. And I agree, Sam, it's just a conceptual thought. It's anything behind whatever you say is the endpoint. And I think you can do more dynamic things without having to specify a mediator for every step of the way.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I think the only place where it ends up being more complex is like when you're doing, you know, potential enterprise environments where they're like doing personal domains inside of enterprises domains. But we haven't really explored that much in the thinking.
We haven't. I can imagine how this can be used in those cases. And I'm confident that we can come up with a good solution. It's also worth noting that this type of routing protocol does not have to be used within that enterprise domain, so long as all the agents involved understand the protocol being used. So there's some flexibility there. And if there's a reason to use a different one, and I think we'll get there. And Stephen, I liked what you said. The way you described it, I think, was very good.
Yeah, I think it how Stephen put it makes a lot of sense, because realistically, you should know everything about your domain if you are the controller of it.
Yes. Yep. Okay. Other thoughts about routing? And I have one that I want to bring up real quick. Okay. So the other one I want to talk about is the pickup protocol. And we have previously called this the queuing protocol, except that it doesn't specifically relate to the existence of a queue, which can also be used for retried transmissions necessarily. This is a protocol specifically about picking up messages. And so the idea here is that you have a status request and a status. This might, you know, the status request says, please give me the status. The status itself can provide information like, hey, you have 70 messages in the queue, and the oldest one is this timestamp, et cetera, and the other types of things there. And then the idea behind batch is it would allow you to retrieve messages as a batch. This is something that would need to be supported, of course, by the receiving agent, but could allow, instead of having to make a new HTTP connection, if that's the transport, to receive each message, they'd be able to ask for a batch of messages and then receive those in return. The other thing that I've lumped into here, I call a no-op message. And we've talked about this before. We have a transport decorator that's been described in an RFC. And the transport decorator describes things not relevant to the message, but the transport itself. The problem is that sometimes you may actually want to send the transport decorator, but don't actually have a message to send it on. And so the idea here is that if we introduce a no-op message that is intended to do precisely nothing, then it allows us to specify things about the transport. And I suspect that the no-op message is actually useful. It's got a question mark here because I suspect it's useful outside of the pickup protocol itself. But I don't know where that is. Is there a no-op protocol that doesn't do anything and there's a no-op message as part of the protocol? That may be true, in which case we could use that. But that's one of the questions that I actually have here. I'll also note that the other part of what we called sort of the queue protocol prior is a queue policy that I talked about last week and have not yet, but plan to write up as a separate protocol itself, because the queue policy relates to both pickup and delivery. And so this is kind of what I'm planning. This would allow you can do pickup without having to use these messages. We've demonstrated that, and it's working in the PR I have into the Ares Cloud Agent Python codebase. But some of these things, like being able to find out how many messages are waiting, are really really useful additions to that. And so this is why I'm thinking about calling things this way. Any thoughts?
Maybe you, instead of no-op, you could just call it ping. Separate from trust ping, but just a one-way ping, which is just hey. And it doesn't mean anything else other than, hey.
That's funny that you say that, because in our testing of the existing of my PR, we used a trust ping with a response request that's set to false. But yeah. I don't love that. Because it means a little bit more than we intended to. We just used it as a function that didn't generate a response, or as a message that didn't generate a response.
Right.
So that's not actually crazy. And ping might be the name of that, although I wouldn't really want to confuse it with the trust ping itself.
See, go ahead, Stephen.
I was just going to say that's the nicest thing anyone said to me today. That's not actually crazy. I like it. Thanks. Go ahead, Kyle.
I would actually tend to think that it'd be a fun exercise to try and use the trust ping in this, just because I'd like to get us thinking about sub protocols. I think it's a little bit more complex, but it would be an easy exercise using the trust ping as the sub protocol inside of a protocol like this.
I don't mind that. My reservation was that I can see trust pings perhaps having a UI element. You might be able to see the last time someone issued a trust ping, for example, and in using them for message pickup could mean very different things. But I like what you're saying about a sub protocol. Maybe if we don't do the ping thing, we should do a no op protocol, and we can experiment with using the no op protocol as a sub protocol.
Yeah, I mean, either or. It's really just more about the fun of the exercise.
For sure.
I know Daniel Hardman has thought about this in the past, so I'd just like to get it as more of a community thinking as well.
Yep. Thoughts?
So previously, when we talked about the transport decorator, we used to have a field in there that indicated the number of messages remaining on the queue, and that was subsequently removed because it ended up being a little bit too much for just getting the transport decorator essentially pushed in as an RFC. So are we saying that there's no way to
use a return decorator?
Not quite. So we have our status request here, and that obviously returns the status of the queue. Is there a way to just kind of tack that on to a message that's already going out in a similar fashion to including the message queue count in the transport decorator like we had before? Or
so conceptually, I think that's a good option. Practically speaking, the way that I modified the conductor in the PR, the message is already encrypted by the time it gets to the queue, which means I can't tack decorators on. Because the message has already been encrypted, and maybe we should change that. But in the current flow of how I've attempted to do things, that's not practically easy, which is why I didn't go that way. It's entirely possible that the queue could be involved prior to the encryption of a message. And in that case, the unencrypted form of the message would be stored itself, and then we could easily transmit the message with the decorator on there. With a batch request, you would actually have a message wrapper around the messages that you're transmitting, and that would allow you to stick a decorator there, but you could also just directly include that as an attribute of a batch message.
So this tends to get more into the crypto side, so we probably don't want to run down the weeds of this too much, but Tobias pointed out that Digital Bazaar has been doing something very similar to our crypto scheme, and they have something where you can actually batch messages together using a single key agreement. Would you see a need for something like that here to optimize the crypto, or would you not really care?
I think it could be an efficient way to do it. The original batch design was actually submitted by Andrew Whitehead, and I brought that up last week. And his were unencrypted. But when I was looking at how I was going to implement this in the conductor, just try to get anything working at all, it was easiest to work with already encrypted but undelivered messages. So So the answer is I do think there is, I think that the batch delivery is a handy optimization, and you bring up that it can be used for crypto as well as connection reuse. But it happens at a higher level, meaning you wrap all the messages into an outer message that's the batch message, and then you send the thing. So in that case, we're not really involving the crypto at a composite message level. We're just treating it like any other message. I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for.
I think it's, you're basically just saying they're architecturally separated and we don't really care. If you have some feature like that, it could be used or it could not. Doesn't make a difference to us.
Yes, I think that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Other thoughts? Okay. I'm going to keep working on this stuff and I will report back as I make progress. Next up on our agenda, we have a discussion of inline keys and DID key references. I've asked Daniel Bloom to mediate this, mostly because he had not yet waded into the fray. But he is doing the mediator role, not really trying to like serve a point. And there's a related issue here that if you have not yet looked at, might be really helpful to the discussion. And with that, I will be quiet for a minute and stop sharing.
Who's taking on the relayer role?
That's a good question. Let's see. So like Sam said, I'm just going to try to give voice to the issue and hopefully facilitate some discussion around it. There's been a lot of discussion already so far from Daniel Hardman, Tobias, and others. But so it's actually two issues that are very closely related here. The sender recipient identifiers used in the envelope for encryption, as well as the usage of inline keys in decorators such as the service decorator. Let's see. And I'm glad Tobias is on the call now, so he can probably elaborate a lot more fully on his ideas here. But just to give a summary, this is probably maybe an oversimplification, but here in the encryption envelope for agent messages, there is a KID attribute. This is the key identifier. And right now it is just a base 58 encoded ED25519 key. However, as we move toward interoperating with other ecosystems, we need some way to specify certain metadata about the key in order to correctly decrypt the message. So Tobias's proposal, I think, was to use potentially the DID key method, which is used by Digital Bazaar, I believe, to represent a key using a multi-codec and some semantics to generate a DID doc from just a public key. And then likewise, in the other issue here on how we can use the same construct for service decorators, potentially, we have the same issue where a key without context, we can't deterministically figure out what we need to do with this key in order to use it correctly. So using DID key to specify both the key type and some other attributes about the key could be potentially useful. So with that, Tobias, is there anything more you'd like to say to give us a little bit more context and get the discussion going?
Yeah, hi guys. I'm currently in an airport right now waiting for my bag, so it's probably not the best time for me to talk. I probably need 5 minutes to just get to a more quieter space so that there's not a whole lot of background noise. But as a summary, I think that's a pretty good start. Is Daniel Hardman there that might be able to add some more commentary?
Unfortunately, I do not believe Daniel Hardman is on the call, which is very unfortunate since he's been the other key participant in the discussion so far. Maybe I can give a brief summary of what he had to say as well. He gave a very thorough response, I think, to how we use key references versus the actual keys. I won't go through everything he said here, but I think in general what he said was that we need to keep a clean barrier, or we need to have clean delineation between the crypto layer and the DID layer. So if we were to use, for instance, a DID key in the encryption envelope, in order to just decrypt the message, we would have to do a DID resolution step, even if it is a very simplified DID resolution where it's essentially just creating a DID doc from the DID key value. That's still a DID resolution step, which pulls the DID layer down into the crypto layer and kind of fuzzies the boundary between those two. So I think Daniel Hardman's stance is to keep that separation between those two layers very crisp by not using DID key. However, he is in favor of using multi-codec in order to express what kind of key we're talking about, which does solve part of the issue.
So how much background noise is there at the moment? So I'm happy to start talking. I just don't want it to be an unpleasant experience for other people on the call. Can anyone hear me okay?
It's not bad, Tobias.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess that's a really good summary, Daniel. Sorry. But a few things I want to sort of delineate between is you have sender identifiers in a message and recipient identifiers. And essentially, when you're encrypting a message, KID is, in fact, to use the language of the spec from the Jose spec, it is a reference that is intended to be meaningful to the recipient. So it's often convenient to put a public key there because public key is intrinsically linked to the private key, which is what the recipient must use to decrypt the message. However, all it is an alias of some sort that must be meaningful to the recipient. So what we use there, we're free to use. And it's also important to point out that you don't need to do DID resolution when you're receiving a message that's a non-crypted or for you, because you possess the DID and you probably know the relationship between the private key and the DID you own. And so that's the first observation you point out. You only even need DID resolution when you are talking about a DID that's you don't control, i.e. a sender's identifier. And so the KID I'm less concerned about in summary, but the problem comes in about the sender. And if you don't have an explicit reference from the sender telling them what DID was linked to the key they signed, then it becomes incredibly hard to establish that relationship. There are exceptions to that case. Obviously, when you have a peer-to-peer, peer-wise relationship, if you can identify the message, the DID in which someone encrypted the message to you that you own, if it's a peer-wise relationship, then intrinsically, because you know the DID they sent it to you, then you know the other half of that relationship and you can therefore identify them. But there are plenty of examples where we're not going to, that's not going to be the only case in DID comms. A great example is the NWISE group of 50, or another more general example is if I have a peerwise DID to an anywise DID relationship and I send the anywise DID a message and there is no recipient identifier for me in that message, when the recipient who owns the anywise DID unpacks it, because the audience of the anywise DID is unbound, there's absolutely no way they can figure out what DID sent them the message. Does that example make more sense?
Yes.
I think we got a yes.
Okay, so all I'm essentially saying is that when a sender is sending something, if they want a higher level identifier above a public key, they probably need to be explicit, otherwise there's room for ambiguity.
Yeah, basically that eliminates that model of communication entirely. So that that model of DidCom where you've got a pairwise on one side, so a person on one side and an enterprise that is using its public DID for all its relationships on the other side. That model would be entirely eliminated by this, the possibility of that model. You may or may not agree with using that model, but without some way of identifying who has sent the message, some other way of identifying who sent the message, that model is eliminated. And that is a concern.
So yeah. I think I missed something. And so I'm hoping someone can point out what I missed as gently as possible. When I receive a message, I can see the recipient key. And then when I can use the recipient key to begin decrypting the message. And part of what I decrypt then is the who the sender actually was, which is a key.
Yeah, but as a key, right? So say I'm a bank and I have a relationship with an individual who gave me their peerwise identifier, and they sent me a message using their peerwise identifier to my anywise did, and I decrypt it. I get back the public key of that did. How am I supposed to, if I had 1,000 relationships, there's so many people that could know that did, with that public key, how am I supposed to link it back to that peerwise did in any practical manner? The audience is unbounded, is what I'm saying. Because anyone can know that anyways did, I can't make that leap.
The key you're seeing, Sam, is your public key, and you use your own private key to decrypt it. So the only thing now you have is your own public key. And in a if it's two pairwise, that's fine. You can figure out which one it uses. But if I'm the enterprise and I'm using my public DID for all of my relationships, I can't tell who sent that to me because they've just sent me my public key.
Yes, but they won't have been able to encrypt the message with their private key. When with authenticated encryption, then you don't just know who the key was. You actually verify that they had the private key as part of the process. So they can say that they can create a malformed DidCom message that has your public key, but they can't create an authentic message that actually has that public key in it because they won't have had the private key in the creation of the message.
I think we're still missing the point here. So if you have a relationship between an anywise did and a peerwise did, anyone can send you a message and put an ephemeral public key in there or a key that's linked to a did. And if I receive a message sent to my anywise did, and all I get back is a key, there is no way for me to determine whether or not the sender was an ephemeral public key or a did that sent it. Because all I get back is a key. There's no difference. And if I get back a key, how do I then leak to the did that was pinned to?
So the problem relates specifically, well, so here's the thing. If this is a relationship you have, right, you've talked with this person before, then you know you in your wallet you have the relationship between the whatever did they gave you and the key they're using, right? And because you can verify, no one can just put the public key in there because of authenticated encryption. That doesn't work. So the question is how you actually identify the relationship that it came from. And I am still unaware of any case where you can't just identify the did by the key that was used in a prior relationship. Now, that what that doesn't relate to is what I can't give a good answer for is how that works with an ephemeral public key. I apologize. I've not yet ridden thoroughly through the issue to understand the previous arguments, but if you have a wallet that allows you to look up a relationship by their public key, then you would be able to identify the did in every case.
Like the Indie wallet today does not have a key to did dereference.
You're correct, but that's a deficiency of the wallet, not a fundamental architectural flaw.
Yeah.
But yeah, isn't it, it's a conflating concern to have to, like, if I got a message sent to my Anywise did, and I'm like, I have 1,000 relationships as a bank with, that everyone knows, you know, 1,000 people know me, that I have established relationships that know my Anywise did. So I get back a public key. Now I have to iterate through those 1,000 relationships and say, is this public key in any of my relationships? When there is also the possibility that it was an ephemeral public key or someone else. And so essentially what I'm saying is you can iterate through your connections list or your list, but it's an impractical solution and it doesn't scale well. Because if a bank had 1,000,000 relationships and somebody with a peer-wise identifier sent them a message and they use the anywise identifier as the reciprocate, there's no practical solution to discern who sent you the message.
Except for indexing by that key, which is the practical solution for how you identify a relationship by the key.
Yes, you have to maintain a reverse index.
Yes, but that's not intractable nor that difficult, right? There's other problems that come with using a did key reference, and that you have to make sure you use a did key reference and include some sort of indicator about what version of the did document that was in case the key was rotated. We got into this discussion before, and the reason why we settled on keys was because if you have to specify enough down so you can get to an individual key, then you might as well just include the key and the problem is solved.
Yeah, Sam, so, on second thought, we should have documented this discussion.
Oh, we totally should have. It was a while ago. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I
do definitely get that you're talking about a point in time for a key for sure, and I think there are other measures we should potentially explore in order to discuss that. But like, either you maintain a reverse index, or the sender just specifies who they are as a reference you might know them by. I mean, like, I don't think this is a highly controversial topic. The way that OpenID Connect works, the way that Did Auth Jose works, Minimal Cipher, Git Did, all of those repos that I link to in this issue all create references that enable an easy establishment of this relationship to an overarching identifier such as a Did. I think there's enough evidence in existing implementations to justify why this isn't a bad idea.
This is Drummond. I've been gone for a couple of weeks, but I've been listening to this whole conversation wondering why there is not such a reference, the sender did included. There must be a reason that we're not doing the obvious thing here.
Yeah, that's my thinking as well.
For the cryptographic layer, the simple answer to it was I just didn't think about that. I was focused more on the shrinking down the size of the message and getting sender anonymity than I was on being able to identify the sender.
Oh, well, that's the answer to everything here, as Kyle hasn't thought about it.
So, I mean, I remember talking about these things as it related to both routing and cryptography, and remember deliberately choosing what we did. We should have better documented those. They may be back in a meeting recording a long time ago on the indie agent call. But yes. So the short answer is I need to stop voicing my opinion until I've read all the way through this issue thread in order to get more precise into the details of it.
I have to drop off. I've got another meeting, but I just wanted to add a comment because there's some comments I added to the discussion thread, and it has to do with the idea of identity-based crypto and the concept that instead of having identity-based crypto says that you embed in the identifier sufficient context that you know how to perform the associated crypto operations. If you use that definition generally and apply that to DIDs, there's lots of ways to use that in these circumstances. If you narrowly define DIDs, then you can say, well, we just don't want to go there. But this concept, in my mind, can answer all of these issues in a generalizable way. And so, you know, it's, I think it's worth thinking about it from that point of view, because there's a lot of research work that's been done on identity-based crypto because of all of the exploits that happen when the context of the identifier and the public key or associated keys become separated from the use of the keys. And so identity-based crypto is embedding that context with the identifier so that there is no separation of context. So you minimize the exploit. And it's an important idea that I don't think we've explored enough in some of these discussions. But anyway, that's all I have time to say. But I wrote some of that up in the thread.
Sam, can you provide like an example of that in the thread later?
Sure. Yeah, well, like actually, if you look in the papers that I reference on the DID for everything, there's multiple examples.
Okay, sounds good. I'll go take a look at those then.
I think what this is saying is it's encouraging the approach that you keep the identifier close, because although we are saying with the approach we're currently undertaking, we aren't identifying at this level, I kind of tend to disagree with that, because the output of this crypto, especially with an authenticated message, is a form of identifier. You know, it's identification-based crypto, as Sam said, in the instance of a public key. And then you have to make one step further to then jump to the actual identifier, you know, the subject by, which is a DID, if you don't have a DID reference at that level. And what I'm saying is that it seems useless or a really hard implementation to have to maintain that at a layer above, and that reverse index and that relationship between those, when if you include the identifier, you can, because it's a self-authenticating identifier, you can do it at that layer. And I think there are sufficient implementations that prove that that is a useful property.
I must say, that does sound persuasive.
So one of the things that we've been talking about on the moving to JWE compliant aspects that's been brought up is to change the sender key from just a base 58 encoded key to a JWK format and encrypting the entire JWK. Is there a field inside the JWK where you can identify the key separately from the actual key material?
I think that's definitely something we should look at. And I think the other option that I did raise at the end of the issue, which I think Daniel explicitly was happy with a potential compromise about, is the idea of potentially not making this behavior non-binding, so that you would include the sender's public key so that you can still verify it to a public key perspective. And then you would keep a separate reference as well, which is like a... And if there is an identifier you potentially want to intrinsically link this back to, which is could even be a URI or a DID, then you can optionally make that next step or just return that reference for the application level to make that link. But at least you have a sender explicitly trying to tell you that rather than putting that burden on the receiver. So you can include both, as I guess is one of the brief explanations I was pointing to.
Okay, that makes sense. And then with regard to Sam's point about knowing state of the key, there is the version matrix parameter that we can use for that, where you can state, you know, if we're using pure DIDs, I can state like the state one or whatever. I'm heavily overwording the word state right now, but and then when you're using something like a public DID, you can link to the transaction sequence number in Indy or a block number in other ledgers.
You can. The previous discussion was that if you have to get that specific anyway, you could also just identify the key, and that helps. It's a really nice speed optimization for performing the cryptography and that's
absolutely fine. But I'm saying, like, the way we're going to refer to subjects in this ecosystem is probably with an overarching indirect identifier such as DID, and so it's fine to identify someone by a key as long as you have a robust mechanism to then jump up the context. And I guess what I'm saying is that maintaining a reverse index and putting that burden on the recipient is an impractical solution when you could just get the sender to specify an optional reference in the message so that the recipient can come to the exact same conclusion.
So what I was talking about, and I agree with what you're saying, Tobias, on the sender side. What I'm thinking about is the recipient, which, you know, as you pointed out, has less resolution concerns. I think the whole point here is we want the identifiers, but we don't want to have to resolve things. Because the resolution is what brings in the conflation of complexity, or the conflation of layers and the additional complexity.
Yeah, so I think what we do is we make that optional. So what you could do is you could return an optional reference, and then the application layer can do that resolution and then give you that firm conclusion that this message did in fact come from a did rather than just come from a key. So you can separate it out, and the product of a decryption will be the sender identified themselves by this public key, which I can tell you it was definitely signed, and this did URL or this other overarching identifier. It's up to you whether or not this did URL is actually mentioning this public key. You need to do that link, but at least you are equipped with that information in the decryption process.
One of the reasons we didn't include two identifiers there, meaning the did and also the key, because that was brought up, is because of potential mishandling in an attack vector, meaning I included did and then a different key, and then any software package that doesn't go through the effort to make sure that the key actually belongs to the did now might have undesirable behavior as it happens. So one of the reasons we discussed was the not, you know, if you have two identifiers that are not in presentation bound to each other, then you have to rely upon the receiver to do a secondary check in order to avoid an attack vector. So not that that's a sufficient reason to not do what you're talking about, but that's one of the things that we talked about.
I definitely hear your concern there, Sam, and you're absolutely right. That vulnerability has been exposed in numerous JWTs where people actually haven't done the due diligence to actually check the signing authority via a URI. However, I don't think you circumvent it by omitting it and causing the recipient to have to go through and maintain a whole bunch of separate states to do it, because I don't entirely think that is the solution either. So you've got kind of three options. One, you force the recipient to maintain a reverse index. Two, you include both. Or three, you just include the identifier you're going to be known at in the ecosystem, which is the DIT. And then you have to do resolution at that level.
Well, another way to put it is that vulnerability is very well known. And Sam Smith's point with identity-based verification is you do in fact, you know, include the identifier and the key so that the context is there. And it is simply part of the verification process. It's like saying, yeah, well, if the verifier doesn't bother to check the signature, then there's a vulnerability there. Yes, this is another vulnerability. If the verifier is going to rely on the presented DID without verifying its relationship to the key, then that's a problem. But if it's well known that that's part of what needs to be done, and that's what you know, the code is designed to do, then you can deal with that vulnerability.
You can. That doesn't mean it's a problem free, but it does mean that at least it is well known, which is good.
Yeah, like the message trust context could be useful in this case. Because the thing that I was thinking about, which is why I was so against doing DIDs only, was when messages are being passed through. If an intermediary hop is not able to resolve its DID, the sender's DID, then they can't actually continue to get the message through, and nobody can get a message. And so at least the middle ground of supporting both solves that. Because if they don't verify the key, it doesn't really matter. Did they still do their job? Sure. At the end of the day, that's what matters in that context, is can they continue to get the message going forward? Not necessarily did they verify the authenticity of the sender.
That actually makes a fair amount of sense when I think about it, because the efficiency of relying on the key, as long as there's no vulnerability that it's that an intermediate routing point is not doing the verification. And it's just up to the end recipient. Yeah, that makes sense. That's actually a strong case for both.
Yeah, I definitely will argue that in a lot of instances, and I think network routing tells us a lot about this as well, that source-based routing and identifying the source of a route or request is often desirable as well. But I definitely hear Kyle's argument that it's not always the case, and you won't always have to authenticate the sender of a message in order to on-forward it. But it's also still useful to be able to do that behavior in certain cases. As Daniel pointed out in some of his examples around potential policy-based routing, based on DIDs, you know, don't send me any messages from this DID between these hours, or be able to create DID whitelists, for example. If I can't determine that this message was from someone inside my whitelist, then block it, and it's a good spam filter.
So would the action item from this be going to evaluate JWK format and see if there's a place where we can put a DID inside of there, and then from there make some modifications inside the comment, and that would help resolve this issue in both cases? Or does this only resolve it for the crypto layer and we still need to figure out what we're doing for the service layer?
In my mind, this doesn't resolve our issue on the services block, which is more related to the concept of an ephemeral DID and DID key. I think that's a separate conversation, but as a resolution to this particular issue, I think you're right, Kyle. And I think the points raised by, is it Gamringer, on one of the issues about the JWE format, we could potentially talk with someone that is familiar with that spec, because I know that in JWSs and in those A spec, they do have designated fields for these types of usually URI-based identifiers. So there's a JKU parameter that can be in a Jose header so that a signature can be bonded back to a URI or a domain authority, for example. And so I wonder whether or not we could suggest having a more generic identifier that will allow URIs and URNs or DIDs. But I'm probably not familiar enough with those explicit specs to advise.
I think it's also worth separating out the various types of concerns, meaning how to encode the type of a key in a string separately from the, you know, what we actually represent as the sender issue. Because they're related but different, and I think conflating them just makes the conversation more confusing. Also, I am will be reading much deeper this particular issue so that I can, you know, not rehash points already made and things like that.
This may be a dumb question. Does a DID need to be, if we were to include this claim, does it need to be included in the cryptographic layer? Can't it be part of the DIDCOM message itself?
Yes. I think the reason it's fallen into the cryptographic layer is because there's an applied property that comes from DID auth that's kind of just tribal knowledge, which is that in authenticating a DID, I'm actually authenticating that a key is used by that DID and is in a valid state.
Well, I think the point it's making is that if it actually went into the application layer, meaning a DIDCOM message had the sender DID as part of it, that you could still decrypt the message with the key that's present. And then inside the message would be the DID that it claims to be. And then you could verify that the, you know, the key and the DID and the DID were the same. Because right now you don't need to do any resolution to decrypt a message.
Correct. And you could do that and you push it up to being a decorated concern. And I have thought about that consideration as well. It's similar to how the ISS field on a JWT works and OpenID Connect, where they mandate it's a HTTPS-based URI. You can do that validation at that level. So there is that consideration. I am just wary about how much we're pumping into this content layer and what the properties of our envelope layer should be versus what the properties of our content layer should be.
So I have a question that I don't have the experience to answer myself, so I'm hoping you guys know. So the keys used to encrypt and verify the envelope at the receiver end are essentially in plain text on the encryption envelope, right?
To encrypt the public key to encrypt is quoted, if that's what you quote, in the KID. And then there will be, depending on whether or not it's author or non-crypt, you've either used an ephemeral public key as a reciprocate or a static public key. Is that correct?
But more specifically, the recipient key is in plain text in the outer message. I mean, you can see it. You can discover what it is without any cryptographic magic. The sender is actually encrypted in part of the payload. So only the recipient can see who the sender was.
Okay.
Otherwise, you just broadcast to anyone who saw the message transfer, who talked to who.
And right. Yeah.
All you know is that the message is designated for a certain individual or a certain key, not who sent it. And then the person who gets it can decrypt the sender as part of the process, and then also decrypt the contents, knowing who the sender was.
Okay. So just to restate, the recipient is in plain text, but the sender, if it's an off-crypted envelope, is encrypted.
Essentially, it's a reference to a recipient, because you don't include the key that the recipient can use to decrypt, because that's their private key. You include the KID is essentially just a reference field, and so whatever you put in there needs to be meaningful to the recipient. So if it's a DID URL, because that's how they index their private keys in their wallet, then so be it. Or more commonly, because of asymmetric crypto, you put a public key there because they're intrinsically linked, and chances are the way they're stored in your wallet is they're related. And so the idea, the way that Unpack works at the moment, is you iterate through those KIDs looking for whether or not you possess the corresponding private key that corresponds to that public key quoted in the KID field.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. So are there any other points to bring up on this issue, or are we good to move on?
We should probably set some time aside for the service decorator specifically to be able to discuss that, or have a discussion at RWAT if people are going to be there for that. Otherwise, moving on to one of the next calls, because I don't feel like that concern has been resolved yet.
It hasn't. We quite specifically, we have not talked about how to indicate what how to do inline keys. We either don't do inline keys at all, or if we do inline keys, we have to make sure that we can specify the type of the key as part of that process.
Yeah. So I think the biggest question I raised on that issue about service decorators is, when we do an inline key, we've identified that multicodec is one of the ways in which we can have a concise representation of a multi-base, multi-type crypto key. And the only observation I was making there was, if we don't have any form of prefix and try and sit under another identifier standard, such as decentralized identifiers, then we are going to have to create a new type of self-certifying identifier, which is essentially just a unique DID in my mind that has one key. And so the argument I was making was, if we do need to represent inline keys, we should explore the idea of making them into ephemeral DIDs instead of just creating another identifier standard that doesn't have any form of prefix.
Right. And in the process, you would specify the key type as part of the DID spec for the key type. And that way it sort of solves the problem, and we have a way of doing that. It's a little bit like we're overapplying DIDs in some ways, but I understand your argument that it might be better than just creating something brand new.
So the rationale I was saying is we would create a new method, like, I don't know, ephemeral DID, or if we could converge on the DID key method, then we would create a new method. We would use the data model that the DID already lines, that the DID spec already outlays to talk about how you resolve an identifier to its underpinning cryptographic information, something you'll have to do if you did a new identifier that didn't have a DID. You'd have to have some form of definition of how I take in an identifier and how it returns me some form of representation around the cryptographic information that key represents. So what I was pointing out is essentially those two processes are exactly the same, and I do respect that there are differences, but I don't think they are sufficient enough to warrant us completely creating a new identifier, which is what we would have to do. And the other objection I had was stripping off any human identifiable component to the start of that identifier if it is an inline key, because I think even though we don't think DIDs will ever be a top-level concern and interact with humans very often, occasionally they will, and if we don't have a human identifiable aspect to an inline key that is essentially a unique public key, I feel like that could create all sorts of developer headaches. And I raised that observation later on. If you were spitting out a public key from SSH and you needed to mutate it to a multi-coded key and there is no prefix to a developer, they will look exactly the same and it will just create all sorts of confusion about their equivalence.
Wouldn't in both cases of the DID key as well as the multi-codic solution, you're relying on multi-codic, so you would want that to be a standard? Don't you have to write this way?
Yep. The specification of the method-specific identifier would be the same as if you, like, to put it in the language of the DID spec, would be the same as if the entire identifier was just a multi-codic public key. I'm just saying that there's been standardized around how public keys are represented as a data model and how they intersect with other identifier standards and whatnot, and we would essentially have to probably replicate that work to get a robust inline public key representation if we departed from using the DID spec.
I mean, really doing DID key is a QA of having the same syntax for all DIDs, and one of them just happens to represent a key. And it's entirely possible, for example, that rather than turning it into the full DID doc representation, you just shortcut hack it and rip out the relevant pieces of information. But it could, if someone was just blindly, you know, resolving the DID and had DID key support in the library they're using to do so, could return a DID doc of the appropriate format. So it's a clever way of telling the difference between an inline key versus a DID. And if we decide that that's useful, then it might be worth producing that. I'm not saying it isn't. I don't have an opinion at the moment. And look, something I said I didn't have an opinion on.
Wait a minute. Everyone has to pause there for a minute and go, what? What did I just hear?
Note the time, folks.
Note the time, yeah. I'm just going to add the DID key is getting quite a bit of discussion. And I'm certainly from this discussion taking away a use that's I'm now understanding is quite different than the DID peer spec is after. Maybe it is. I mean, even if it turns out to be just a simpler form of accomplishing the same thing that the codec does, it may be very useful. I'm not opposed, and I think the growing community of interest in DIDs and the potentially about to end vote, by the way, anyone on here who is in the W3C and the organization hasn't voted, please vote for the DID working group so we get that thing officially started. It may just be easier for the code to be there and for everything that touches keys to have a representation of DIDs.
Someone started talking and then muted. Who was that?
Oh, sorry. So if you do make a DID key method, you put the onus on all of the implementers to actually to encode, to be able to generate a DID document from that DID key. And that would be every single implementer would actually need to know how to do that. So I think that's going to be an uphill battle. And I think
hang on, let me get that one, Tobias. I think that no matter what you do, people are going to know how to read that value and get their meaningful information out of it. So if it's multi-codec stuff or whether it's some other format, they're going to need to know how to make that happen. And the onus is on all of them to do that. And in reality, then the common libraries will support this sort of a thing and it will work. It's important to note that you don't actually have to turn it into a DID document before you extract the keys. You could, but it's also entirely possible that you have a method that says, give me the keys for this DID doc. And when in the cases of a DID key, it just rips it out in a more direct manner without actually creating and then extracting the pieces of the DID doc that it needs to make.
Yeah, exactly. I think your observation's exactly right there, Sam. Regardless, you're going to have to possess an API that can decode a multi-codec. It's really an argument of whether or not you want that to be a consistent data model, which I say is definitely a very good byproduct, rather than an application-specific one that gives rise to ambiguity and completely different implementations of the exact same thing. So that would be my rationalization of that.
I think as far as
my thought on
test cases for this, and I think that's a weak argument in favor of it. The advantage is that it presents a consistent encoding and there's a lot less ambiguity there. But I'll shut up, Stephen. What do you got to say?
I mean, my thought is DID key is what I realized what it was, is which is just taking DID key, using the multi codec thing to decrypt so that you have a representation as the string DID colon key colon and the multi codec and then the actual public key, and then just sticking that into a template that's predefined. It's not a DID. And so putting the DID in front of it seems kind of silly to me. I like stopping at the multi codec, but the other side of it is, because the DID key, the DID doc template has been predefined and has a whole bunch of extra stuff that we don't use in this community, at least, and there's not a plan to, then that just seems to be introducing confusion. And so I'm not sure why we think it's actually helpful. But you know, when the thing's not actually a DID, it's a key. It literally is a key. It's great. The multi-codec piece. Beyond it, I don't get it.
I think the observation here, though, is what is a DID? A DID is a decentralized identifier, and what this multi-codec representation is an identifier. I would push back and say this is definitely a DID. It's just a DID that can only support one key. It's a decentralized identifier that represents a public key, just like another decentralized identifier can represent multiple keys and service endpoints. Like, there is no firm definition
about what... But the resolution of that, my problem is the resolver. The resolver for DID key comes back with a very specific format that has all sorts of extra candy in it that's not of interest to everybody.
Absolutely. So
in the digital bazaar model, it fits exactly what they need because they defined it, but it doesn't fit any other community's need as far as I can see.
I completely resonate with that, and that's why I've made it incredibly clear that there would be either we would have to create our own ephemeral DID or we would have to negotiate around the presence of some of those fields in that identifier.
Right.
But
okay.
I'm essentially talking about the generalized notion of an ephemeral DID and the usefulness of taking a public key, multi-codecing it, and then actually putting it under the decentralized identifier, because that's essentially what it is, versus stripping off that identifier and creating a completely new identifier just based on the multi-codec prefix.
Well, so hang on. We're really talking about very narrowly one thing. Do we want to bind the future of inline keys to the DID spec, or do we not want to bind the encoding of inline keys to the DID spec? Because
that's not really what the DID key method does. The DID key method takes two strings and takes the template that you're seeing on the screen and sticks the two strings you've got into a whole bunch of places.
No, I know, but what, you're right. So it is a little bit more to that, right? But even with what Tobias is saying, we negotiate the presence of some of these keys or some of these other things that are in there. That's fine, but the fundamental thing that we're talking about is that it is convenient to represent this. I understand Tobias's argument and I understand Stephen's, right? But the difference between the two arguments is whether the problem is if we bind this and say this is the way we're going to do it. Then we end up with the future of the DID spec either way. That might be good or it might be bad. Future revisions and other things that happen are going to affect how we encode inline keys. If we don't, if we just represent it with an encoding, then the independent of DID key.
Interesting.
Then we avoid all future benefits and problems
that is come with the DID spec. That is absolutely the only thing I would push back on is that is not an incomplete, it's not a complete binding. You are still free to drop that prefix later if the DID spec moved in a way that was more suited to decentralized identifiers rooted on public sources of truth or that sort of stuff, and it steers in a direction that DID key is impractical anymore. What's to stop you from creating a new inline key reference? Like I don't see that you have to leap in one or the other way. It's really the decision about which direction we want to steer right now.
Well, we can get around either of them. We can also, if we decide to go the inline way, later decide to use DID key. So we can in the future we can do either one. I think the question is right now what's the most practical thing to do for now in the next several years.
So I'm not going to RWAT, but Tobias, if you can convince DID key to drop basically the series of fields that aren't in the DID spec, that aren't specifically referenced, in other words, that aren't extensions to the DID spec, which I last I checked would be everything below authentication in this. I believe they are very happy with it.
I would just say though, I think looking at the JSON-LD context object that's defined in the DID spec, and perhaps Drummond can advise here, that I think assertion method, capability delegation, key agreement, and capability invocation are included in the JSON-LD context for a DID document.
I don't think they are for a generic DID document. I think those are Digital Bazaar specific things.
Sam, did you mess up the context here?
Sam, if you just jump to that DID context URL, can we just have a look and see what is there?
I'm not sure it resolves, but you can try.
One of them resolve. Yeah. So oh, is there go. A...
Whoa.
Yeah, capability invocation, so...
There's a whole lot more in this than the last time I looked at it.
Yeah, so that was the observation I made the other day, because usually you have to overload the context with another... JSON-LD context if you want to add additional fields, is that correct? And so that's when I saw that that DID doc example. I assume those
Holy
fields must
cow.
Be part of the DID doc.
I know, I'm sitting here looking at this going, wait a minute, we this wasn't something that we spent time on working on the DID spec. This is a Digital Bazaar heavily inspiration.
You look up the DID spec, it doesn't have all those.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That was actually very, very useful, Tobias, just to point that out and take a look at it. So,
wow.
In fact, I would argue strongly against many of those things because that goes way beyond the generic level that the DID spec should be at.
Drummond, okay, are you going to RWAT? Is this something you're going to take up with Manu?
It's important to mention that there are several issues I think we're going to have to relitigate in the DID spec as it goes into a working group. I know the credentials community group is pretty satisfied with where it's at. It's made a lot of progress. But as we've started to dive into implementations, I know especially Dave Hughesby working on the Rust implementation has shown that there's several things inside the current DID spec that we thought would go more smoothly for implementers than they've gone.
Yep.
So point of order, it's 2:31. We are at the end of our meeting time. Do we want to continue now or have we sufficiently argued this and we need to go think and argue and write stuff?
I I just dropped some more information about the multi-key, multi-base, multi-hash for AD25519 in the chat.
Thank you.
I am interested in being involved in some of the discussions, Drummond, if you are going to talk about that sort of stuff.
I'm not going to be at rebooting. Part of the reason is I am going to the first meeting that did working group, assuming the vote's successful in Japan, which is the week of the 16th of September. So is anyone on this call planning to be at rebooting?
I am.
Okay.
I'll be there as well.
And Daniel Hardman is planning to be there. So by all means, you have you take our proxy to wrestle this to the ground and, you know, make sure, you know, you can please share our reaction to the, what we just looked at in the context document with Manu and gang, because that's the only source I'm aware of that. We have never discussed that on a did call that I've been on.
So I have a feeling that they've actually mixed up their two contexts. Because if you go look at the context of the Varus 1 specific context, it has a lot less than that.
Oh.
So maybe they're just publishing these two things to the wrong place.
You may be right. If we could figure that out, that might be worth Kyle a message to the W3C community group to just say, hey, we just spotted this. Is there a mistake here? I expect someone from Digital Bazaar. Well, we'll get an answer one way or the other.
Sounds good.
Yes,
I'll fire a message off and just like screenshot the two differences, because I was taking a look at the other Varus ones yesterday, and it had a lot less information than that. I actually hadn't even seen that one before.
Got it. Very helpful.
Perfect. Okay, folks. Thank you. Good luck to those going to RWAT. We appreciate your service there and look forward to hearing what happened. And I will get this recording posted. And thanks all.
Thanks, guys.
Sam. Yeah. Thanks, Tobias. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. See you.